Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Ted Mooney about his new novel, The Same River Twice.
What I really wanted to get at in this book is how people who see themselves as morally upright and regular citizens at the same time blind themselves to the larger part of what's going on all around them all the time.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Bruce Handy discusses two big-ticket kids' books.
To me, it almost seems like kind of an evil idea. Like, kids really want to read about, you know, corporate lawyer intrigue or something like that.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Ted Mooney has had one of the most interesting and ambitious literary careers of the modern period. He's not only a first-rate novelist, he also was for many years a senior editor at Art in America and knows a great deal about the intersecting worlds of literature and art, and they're in display in his new novel. It's called The Same River Twice. It's reviewed for us this week by Danielle Trussoni, who says she was mesmerized by Mooney's storytelling gifts and says The Same River Twice is a novel that has it all. I'm delighted that Ted Mooney is here to talk about his book. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you.
All right, so we have, as Trussoni says, a really literary novel on the one hand, and you're an established literary novelist, and also a kind of thriller. So what's the story? Who are the people we learn about here?
The main characters are an American independent filmmaker who is married to a Parisian independent dress designer, and they live together in Paris. Their professions mean, of course, they have no money ever. They're always raising money. And while he is in New York visiting his first wife, she accepts an invitation to become a courier to go to Moscow, pick up some objects and bring them back to an auction house with no details really given to her. She's paid well for this, and she, needless to say, she brings back in her trail many unpleasant circumstances related to Moscow.
And this, in many ways, is a novel about Paris.
It is. I was spending a lot of time in Paris at that time, and in fact, what I was on the track of was the Armed Islamic Group, which was active in Algeria. And I was finding out things that I thought that was what I was going to write about. This is way before 9/11. I began thinking about this in 1996. And then I thought, I don't think anyone's going to want to hear about this. So I dropped that, even though I knew the very country in Western Bar where the JEA members' heads would meet every Friday to determine who would be killed in Algiers that week.
And how did you get onto that story? I mean, I think of you as kind of high culture, glam guy. Why telling that particular story?
I suppose I'm high culture. At least I don't disdain it. But what I do when I visit a city, I guess I don't really take vacations. I spend 14, 16 hours a day in the street. And if you just look, I do owe this to my years in the art world, I think, in some way. If you keep your eyes open and look at everything as if you've never seen anything of that kind before, you discover amazing things. They're all there to be seen. It's what I really wanted to get at in this book is how people who see themselves as morally upright and regular citizens at the same time blind themselves to the larger part of what's going on all around them all the time.
Ted, our reviewer, Danielle Trussoni, who's an accomplished novelist herself, particularly admires your descriptive prose. And she sees in it the influence of all the art you've looked at, all the art criticism you've edited. Is she right?
I think she is right in this way. I edited literally thousands upon thousands of reviews of art exhibitions, after which I concluded reluctantly that there is at most a 10% overlap of people who really know how to look at things and people who can write. And my job, obviously, was to find that overlap and keep them writing for us.
And so when you create the painterly descriptions you have in this novel, which also have to work as language, you're drawing on the influences of the criticism you've read. What about your own experience at looking at art? Does that also train your
eye? I'm really not drawing on the criticism at all. I learned how to look and how to teach people to look, which is something that we – because sight is such a rapacious sense, we tend to think that it's something everyone knows how to do, but that's not so, particularly people who are good with words. If you stand in front of an artwork of even medium value, you really have to spend some time cleaning your mind of words utterly and just begin to look and keep yourself as blank as possible for as long as possible, and you will begin to see the relations of things, how they fit or don't, and eventually you'll be able to see the object whole, and then you can start letting words come in again, and they will be the right words. If you do the same thing at a street corner, it works too, by the way.
And what about like describing a relationship, as you do in this novel? What about understanding how minds of work, how characters think? And
well, I discovered that I believe this by writing the book, that every second of every day, people believe, often in perfectly good faith, that they're doing one thing when they're actually doing something completely different. And this is what I find to be the true poignancy of being human. I mean, it's tragic, it's comic, and in its own peculiar way, I mean, I'm human too, it's beautiful.
And Ted, when you decided to pursue this genre, did you prepare yourself for it by immersing yourself in this kind of fiction, or did this just come to you as a kind of story you wanted to tell at this time?
No, I'm afraid I'm not an expert on the thriller form. My idea of a thriller would be Javier Marías's last 1,500-page tome. But I am very good in the streets, and that's where I do my research. I don't think you can do your research on Google. I think it's impossible. You need to get into trouble, get out of trouble. You need to see the things that the people who live in that place can't see because they have their own routines.
Thanks a lot, Ted.
Thanks.
It's Ted Mooney, whose new novel, The Same River Twice, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Big shakeup in publishing. Somebody's in and somebody's out.
Yes, we have a shakeup at Simon & Schuster this week. It all happened relatively quickly. David Rosenthal, one of the most prominent people in the publishing world, resigned from Simon & Schuster
yesterday. And what was his job there?
He was the publisher of Simon & Schuster, of their flagship imprint. So he had published more than 100 new hardcover books every year, a mix of fiction, nonfiction, a lot of big political books, Bob Woodward. So it was a big surprise, and he'll be replaced by Jonathan Karp, who's coming from the 12 imprint at Hachette, which is a very different business model. They only publish 12 books every year, once a month, and it was Jonathan Karp's idea, it was his concept, and he started it 5 years ago. So here he is going to Simon & Schuster, where he'll have a very different experience.
So the idea behind 12, which was kind of halfway between a gimmick and actually sort of a brilliant concept, was one book a month, one author, that's where all your forces are concentrated. Now he goes to a publishing house, which, although a great and prestigious one, it's almost like an assembly line. So many books come out. So why would they tap him to do that?
Well, he's very smart. He's young. He's 46. David Rosenthal had been in the business for a very long time, and they might have felt like they needed to shake things up. He's very well respected, and he also has a great ability to convince authors to come over. So he might be pulling some of his most prominent authors along with him.
Do we have any idea what's next for David Rosenthal?
We don't. He hasn't said yet. I don't know what he's up to or what he's planning, but I imagine he might take a little bit of a break for a while. So we'll have to see on that.
Julie, there are surprises and surprises. Did this really come out of the blue, or were there rumblings for a long time that there would be a shakeup of some kind at Simon & Schuster?
I think it was a genuine surprise. On Wednesday afternoon, the rumor started flying that Rosenthal was out. So Simon & Schuster didn't confirm it until Thursday morning when they announced that Jonathan Karp would be taking over. So I think the people were genuinely surprised. But Simon & Schuster, unlike a lot of the other publishing houses, has not done a lot of layoffs, unlike Random House. So they may have been overdue for a big shakeup.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Glad to be here.
Children's books continue their assault on the bestseller list and also, it seems, in everyone's consciousness. There are two new ones, one by a very famous children's books author, another by a bestseller who's venturing into children's territory for, I think, the first time. The books are The Red Pyramid, The Kane Chronicles by Rick Riordan, and the second book, Theodore Boone, Kid Lawyer by, yes, John Grisham. They're both reviewed for us by the great Bruce Handy, deputy editor at Vanity Fair and regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review, and he's here to talk about them. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So these guys are heavyweights. Let's start with Riordan. This is a series he's written?
Yeah, this is the first book in what you know, I presume will be a three, four, five book series. It doesn't quite say. Riordan is previously wrote the Percy Jackson and the Olympians series, which is kind of it's an interesting series. It's a fun series. It's kind of a knockoff of Harry Potter to some extent. It's about a bunch of kids who it posits a world where Greek gods are real and have relocated to modern day America, and the heroes of the book are demigods. Like the main character, Percy Jackson, his father is Neptune, and there's his sort of love interest, her mother is Athena, and they go on these adventures and sort of have to save the world from like a big supervillain, sort of the same way Harry Potter does. And they have a sort of a school/camp where they get training, kind of like Hogwarts. But they're clever books, and they're fun in their own rights. I kind of I sometimes compare it to if J.K. Rowling is the Beatles, then Rick Riordan is kind of like Badfinger.
And hugely successful.
Yes, they've been all his books have been all over your children's series bestseller list. This new book is kind of it's interesting. In some ways, it feels like more of the same. This is in this world now. It's the Egyptian gods are real and relocated to. There is sort of it's a little bit more global than the Percy Jackson books. This one, they bounce around from, it starts in London, then they're in New York, then they're in Paris, then they're in Cairo, then they're back in, the climax takes place in Arizona. So they're, it's a little bit more global. But again, it's kind of like teenage characters, dealing with Egyptian gods, and their father is an Egyptologist, except maybe he might have some sort of deeper connection to the world of Egyptian mythology, which was sort of explored as the book goes on.
Is Riordan well versed in the myths he discusses?
Well, I'm not an expert on the subject, but my son actually has been studying it in school, and all the stuff in the books he seems to think is pretty accurate. I mean, there's clearly he's clearly put some research into the subject. It's a nice mix of the actual characters and consistent with the actual myths, but with a lot of playfulness as well. And they're incredibly fast paced books.
Now, what about John Grisham, Theodore Boone, Kid Lawyer?
Well, I gotta say, I was actually a little. Everybody I know in publishing, when they first heard about this Grisham book, was like, almost literally smacking their foreheads and going, "Oh my God, what an ingenious idea!"
Why didn't they think of it?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like a legal thriller for kids. I mean, to me, it almost seems like kind of an evil idea. Like kids really want to read about, corporate lawyer intrigue or something like that. But I gotta say, fortunately, it turns out this kid is actually not a lawyer. He's kind of a legal buff, and his parents are lawyer, and he's a kid who hangs out in the courtroom. It's almost, in some aspects, it has a little bit of To Kill a Mockingbird.
What does the plot turn on in this novel by Grisham?
The central plot is about a man who's on trial for his having strangled his wife to death, and it's sort of complicated because it seems like he's pretty clearly guilty, but the prosecution just has this very weak circumstantial case. But the book's hero, Theo, actually uncovers this mystery witness who can place the defendant at the scene of the murder. So that's kind of the hinge of the plot. It's kind of interesting, though. I mean, I think Grisham was very scrupulous. I'm neither an expert in Egyptian mythology, nor am I a lawyer. But to the extent that I could tell, it's very scrupulous to the ins and outs of criminal law and courtroom procedure. So that's kind of a nice part about the book. And it's also a very sort of sweet whole. It takes place in this kind of small city, and it's almost like parts of it almost have like a Beverly Cleary almost sort of sweetness and innocent, a kid kind of riding his bike through leafy lanes. And so, yeah, in some ways, it's probably the most wholesome book ever written about somebody strangling their wife to death. But, for all that, I wonder. I mean, I found it lacking kind of in the suspense thing, because basically what happens is in the end, I don't want to give too much away, but the kid basically doesn't really know what to do, and he sort of brings in the adults, which I, on one hand, I kind of admire, because there's so much so much kids' fiction and film, and especially TV, you know, like Nickelodeon, if you're watching Nickelodeon or, you know, Disney Channel, where adults are just nothing but boobs and stuff. So I like a world where adults are actually seen as being an adult. I like a world where adults are actually seen as somebody who can, you know, help out a kid in a jam. But I just wonder whether it doesn't have the kind of ingenious snap of his adult books.
Bruce, how well does he get inside the mind of a child? Does Grisham do that convincingly? Does he have a feel for children, do you think?
Well, if I can turn that around, how well does Grisham get into the minds of adults in his in his adult fiction? I'd say it's on a par with that. So you can, people can take that however they wish.
Bruce, you've been writing a lot of reviews and essays for us on children's literature. I've known you for a long time as a writer on culture, high and low. And what is the attraction? You seem to be working toward some real ideas about children's literature. You take these books very seriously, not ponderously, but seriously. Are they really important books, do you think? Just the genre of children's literature significant in a way now that maybe we had overlooked for a long time?
Well, yes, I think it's hugely important. I mean, these are the books that form us. I mean, these are how we learn to read. I mean, you go back and look at, something like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, which is one of the first books that parents read to their kids. I mean, that's one of the first jokes kids read. I mean, you know, in some ways that book, you know, it has the structure of a joke, you know, da-da-da-da. You know, action, 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 and then there's a great twist at the end where the caterpillar turns into first he eats, you know, eats through all the, you know, the sausage and the lollipop and all this stuff, which is very funny. And then he turns into a butterfly. There's a great twist. You know, that's probably the first great plot twist a lot of kids encounter. I think of Goodnight Moon. You know, there's that great line, Goodnight Nobody. I mean, that's like the first meta joke, you know, kids see. These books totally form us. They teach us narrative. They teach us about character. You know, the way adult books teach us about the world and how the world works and how emotions work. So do kids' books. I think, I'm a huge fan of Beverly Cleary. I think I mentioned earlier. I mean, I think, Ramona the Pest, which I think is her masterwork, you know, is an amazing book. And that's a book that really gets into the mind of a kindergarten character. It's almost, I mean, to me, you know, it has elements of social comedy that, I don't want to make too great a claim, but in some ways, are in their way as great, I think, as stuff in Jane Austen. And I think also there's a real like psychological complexity to that book and to that character of Ramona. And that even as an adult reader, I find, you know, moving and interesting.
Thanks a lot, Bruce.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Bruce Handy, who this week reviews The Red Pyramid by Rick Riordan and Theodore Boone, Kid Lawyer by John Grisham. Jennifer Schuessler's here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, we've got a new book on top of the fiction list. Lee Child is back with his latest thriller, 61 Hours, and John Sanford enters at number 2 with Storm Prey. I think we're in full escapist summer reading mode on the bestseller list. Oh, wait, we're always in escapist summer reading mode on the bestseller list.
Plenty to escape from.
Exactly.
What about nonfiction?
Well, Laura Bush is still at number 1 with her memoir, Spoken from the Heart. Jonathan Alter enters at number 4 with his book, The Promise, about the first year of President Obama. You know, except for Alter, the nonfiction list is looking pretty rock-ribbed Republican. We've got Newt Gingrich down at number 5 with his book, To Save America, subtitled Stopping Obama's Secular Socialist Machine. And Aaron Klein's Manchurian President, Barack Obama's Ties to Communist Socialists and Other Anti-American Extremists, is at number 19 on the extended list. And then there's Fred Thompson. Remember him?
I sure do.
Law and Order star, one-time GOP presidential hopeful. He's on the extended list with his book, Teaching the Pig to Dance. And on closer inspection, the title appears to refer to his Tennessee childhood, not to a proposed strategy for taking back the White House.
Well, speaking of being caught between right and left, what about Elena Kagan? What should she be reading this summer?
Well, I hesitate to make any casual recommendations to such a busy woman, but she might want to check out Philip Margolin's thriller Supreme Justice at number 11 on the fiction list. It's about two Supreme Court justices who come under attack in connection with a death row appeal that could expose a criminal plot in the CIA. Got that?
I think so. Now, what about your own summer reading?
Oh, you know, I've got a big pile as usual, but I have to confess, the book I'm most excited about is a book that's at number 9 on the paperback how-to and advice list. It's Stephen Raiklin's Planet Barbecue. Raiklin, as I'm sure you know, is the television barbecue guru, host of Primal Grill. In here, he makes pit stops with pit masters around the world, Uzbekistan, Kenya, Spain, wherever. He's been there to get their barbecue secrets. And I was quite relieved to learn that, you know, when a German invites you over for some Schwenken or swinging, he's really just offering you pork steaks cooked on a grill suspended over a beech wood fire. I was a little more disappointed to learn that monkey gland sauce, which is a staple at South African barbecues, is strictly vegetarian.
I think I won't have lunch today. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.